Coming up on TechNation, the compelling motivation for humans to innovate. First up is Gary Shapiro, the president of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, which hosts the annual CES show in Las Vegas. Tech firms globally come to show off their latest technology. But where does all this innovation come from? It turns out every single one of us. I speak with composer and Rice University professor Anthony Brandt and neuroscientist and inventor David Eagleman. Together they look at how human creativity remakes the world. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
There I was, watching an episode of House of Cards. President Francis Underwood was working on his inaugural speech, and there on the coffee table in front of him, amid an artful spread of working papers, was an old-fashioned manual typewriter, just like my mother used to have. And of course, my mother had an Underwood. This fact couldn't have escaped the writers, for what a joke! An Underwood for an Underwood, if it was an Underwood. Nevertheless, it had all the memorable qualities. As in, these jokers were boat anchors. They weighed a ton, figuratively speaking, and the effort to type each key. A half-hearted attempt, and your key didn't strike. But the carriage holding your single sheet of paper moved one character to the left anyway, and you had to hit backspace. There's a certain definitiveness watching each long, thin metal arm with the typeface of a single character rise up and hit the paper. But type too fast, and these arms will jam together. You need a rhythm, like playing a real piano as opposed to an electronic keyboard. Underwood's typewriter was a prop, present in earlier plot twists, and no doubt destined for others. But what I didn't know was that I would soon be accosted by manual typewriter fever. I saw one in an internet ad, and another in the photo of a famous writer who surely didn't type each book's 90,000 words on that beast, given multiple rewrites and passages ultimately abandoned. Longhand begins to look good. Either that, or plan on consuming 10,000 calories a day to keep up your strength. Still, it's bigger than that. Manual typewriter festivals and more. I entered manual typewriters on my search page, and the first entry astonished me. It turns out that besides Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote another Tony Award-winning musical. And the headline of a review had spelled Lin-Manuel as Lin-Manuel. I read the entire review before I gave up on the hope that there were pithy raps about manual typewriters and bounced to the next choice. And there it was, Gold, a documentary about a shop in Berkeley called California Typewriter and its struggle to keep going for 34 long years. Of course, they just love typewriters, as does Tom Hanks, who owns 250 of them, which I personally find inexplicable. There were songwriters like John Mayer and even playwright Sam Shepard, who contributed, "When you ride a horse, you have to saddle it. When you use a typewriter, you have to feed it paper." Appreciation was also voiced for the fact that the typewriter doesn't give a hoot about your misspelled words. There have been a lot of tech improvements since the 1875 Stoles and Glidden through to the 1980s Smith Corona and the IBM Selectric with its replaceable font ball. Erasable paper, lighter tapping on the keys, and even an erase button, which remembered what characters you typed, moved the carriage back a letter where a second typewriter ribbon, this one white, struck the key again and removed the letter you just typed. The solution to more than one crime story rested in reading the erase tape backwards. But back to Underwood's Underwood. It had none of these features. Definitely pre-World War II, when typewriter manufacturers stopped making them and turned their metal technology skills to the war effort. But let's pay attention. A lot of folks really like these typewriters, which says something about being human. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, innovation and technology. First, I'll speak with Gary Shapiro, who heads CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, about the state of technology and tech jobs, both in the U.S. and globally. Then Anthony Brandt and David Eagleman, the music professor and composer, joins a neuroscientist and inventor to write The Runaway Species, How Human Creativity Remakes the World. You might know Gary Shapiro best from his 2013 book, Ninja Innovation. But he's also the longtime president and CEO of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, which produces the annual CES show every January in Las Vegas, where the world's technology firms all come together to show their wares. Well, Gary, welcome back to Tech Nation.
I am so happy to be back.
You know, I was reading your materials and saw, this shocked me, there are over 260,000 unfilled tech jobs in the U.S.
At least. In the Washington, D.C. area alone, there's probably 80 or 90,000 for people who do data analysis, people who write software apps. And we're going to new directions soon, too. People who could deal with self-driving cars. There's a huge shortage. It's one of the reasons that sometimes companies go abroad. So what's weird about the country is, though, our employment situation is at a record high number of full-time employees. We're actually doing okay. We're at 160 million Americans employed, but there's still several million unemployed, and there's a few million open jobs. The disconnect is in education, and frankly, it's also in geography. A lot of people in rural America don't want to move to where the jobs are because of family, because of personal situations, and it's understandable. While we can't really correct the geographic difference, we have to start working as a nation on the difference in skills, the mismatch, because our educational system is exactly what it was 100 years ago. The same things are taught, some of them less necessary now than perhaps. In my world, perfect world, we would teach coding as a requirement, and then everyone would know how to do it, and then we'd have a highly skilled nation, as the other countries are starting to look at doing. So we thought it was so important that we created a whole new position, a vice president of American jobs, and we're focusing on how to close the skills gap, and also how to go after and link up veterans, for example, where we have now a nationwide database that takes all the military job classifications and puts them in English. So if you're leaving the military, we can go to all our member companies and, frankly, other companies that want to do it. It's all free. They'll scrape the open jobs. They'll give them to veterans. And if you're a veteran in Mississippi that had some classification in one branch of the service, you could find out what jobs would be a good match for you in Mississippi or anyone else, where else you want to move to. So, I mean, that's a long way of saying we need good people. And to stick with the military just for a second, they're the type of people most employers want because they show up on time, they're disciplined, they're problem solvers, they work well on teams, and they have a passion. And that's what we want.
It's complicated, but it's not overwhelmingly complex. I mean, I see here there's 450,000 military vets looking for work. This is significant. And we all know that the military has always trained people in technology.
In fact, I would submit the military is the best jobs program we have. You take a lot of kids right out of high school that don't have a lot of skills, and you transform them into people who could speak good sentences, communicate clearly, deal in a team, and they're eager to help and eager to work, and they've been part of something bigger. And to me, military service is an enormous positive qualification for an employee.
I see you work here with ustechvets.org, and that's a nonprofit, and that helps vets get jobs, but also their spouses.
Yes, and that's an increasing challenge. A large percentage, I think it's over 30% of spousal families, things happen, people move along, and it leaves them vulnerable, and it's difficult, frankly. So it's just not the veterans themselves. It's a challenge. Their families deserve support as well, and there's a lot of great organizations. Tech Vets is certainly very, very important. We've given $250,000 to expand that on a national basis and get more people engaged, but we really want to make sure that we could do everything we can to help our military and, frankly, help our own employers tap everyone they can. But what technology has changed and what the world has changed dramatically is that now you have people with disabilities, you have women in the workforce, you have minorities, you have a great stream of people, and employers and people in America, hopefully, are more conscious that the more diversity they have, the more different people they could tap, the greater they'll be as employers, the more productive they'll be with different ideas coming in. And our national strength is our diversity. Because I see this because I travel around the world and I say, other countries are very homogeneous. And the advantage of that is they've solved some problems that divide us. So they have thousands of years of the same religion and culture and all that. We're a new country, a couple hundred years old, and we're good at disagreeing with each other. And that's okay as long as you recognize that ultimately we're still in the same country. We're aiming towards the same thing, which I think is a better life for our kids and the next generation.
Well, one of the challenges is that whether you were coming out of the military or you went to college here in the U.S. or even high school, wherever you went, if you get into technology, your technology is going to become obsolete before you blink. This is something that takes constant updating. This is new for the United States, new for the world, that the whole idea that you might have to change what you know on a constant basis. We face that basically as a nation and as a world.
That's a great point. But I think that if you learn one technology or two technologies, it's going to be easy to learn the third and the fourth.
You learn how to learn technology.
And, you know, my mother raised me to be a lifelong learner. And I would say, why do you spend all this time listening to radio? And she said, Gary, if you get one thing out of it for an hour, then you've learned something, which is the most precious thing you could have. So I think that's what we have to adopt as a nation. Learning just doesn't end with high school or college. Learning is continuous. And the other thing that's changed dramatically, I believe, is the concept of working on a team. And it used to be that was less important. Now it's really important. And it's important that you can work across cultures with different people. And that's the strength we have, especially going to the military. Boy, what are you doing? You're working with so many different people. And you're working, you might be going globally and dealing with other cultures. And that's part of the military training now, because a lot of it is the soft part of the military, of going in there and helping, I hate to say nation building, or whatever it is, you have to be able to deal with people. It's almost like police training. It's a matter of how to deal with people and diffuse a situation and understand emotional intelligence, understand body language, understand who you could trust and count on your colleagues and your teammates. And that's what we have to do as a country. We certainly have to do it in the workplace.
Now, one of the things that has been so interesting and something you started last year was the innovation scorecard, because it's not just technology. Innovation drives tech. Innovation drives jobs.
Absolutely. So this is our third year having done it. We ranked each state as to how innovation friendly they are. And we use some very objective criteria and, frankly, some subjective, but it's all transparent and it's out there. And what we said is we looked at the broadband speed, we looked at education, STEM education, we looked at friendliness to new business models like Uber and Lyft, Airbnb, to drones, to self-driving cars, and whether the state is supporting or encouraging them. We looked at all sorts of things, at labor policy, tax policy, ratings, brother. And then we said, here's the top quartile, and here's the bottom, and here's the second and third. And we have a lot of what we call innovation champions. In 2017, we had Colorado, Maryland, New Hampshire, and Washington, which were new. And back as top winners, we had Delaware, Massachusetts, Michigan, North Dakota, Utah, and Virginia.
And not California.
Well, California has some issues, frankly. It's high tax, very, very high regulation state, and that, frankly, hurts it. I mean, there's some things, and a lot of employers, to be honest, although I'm here with you in California, are leaving California because it's, you know, if you're an employee here, you're paying 10% income tax, there's the taxes on business, there's more rules, and that does not help. Now, what we're doing that's exciting, I'm pleased to say, I think for the first time with media, is that we are, our hope is to expand this globally. So everyone says the U.S. is the most innovative country. Everyone wants to be like you. So some of the things we do, we can't rank states on because we do it throughout the United States. We have this wonderful thing called the First Amendment. We have freedom of expression, freedom of religion. We have a real democracy where people actually make choices. We do all sorts of things. We have freedom of access to anywhere on the internet, if you will. And you compare that with China, for example, where, you know, they don't allow Google, they don't allow Twitter, Facebook is banned, the Apple's kind of being restricted a little bit. They have all sorts of different rules. They don't have a real democracy. They don't have freedom of religion. These are the things that attack innovators. They want freedoms. If you can't go anywhere on the internet, how are you going to create and invent things? So, and the world could be heading towards a world where you have China's view of the world, which is a little more central control and restrictions on individuals versus the U.S., which is individuals are really empowered. And that's why we disagree so often. We don't like it. And we might be fighting the rest of the world, but we're looking at the developed countries where there's a lot of information. And we'll be saying, here's what we consider important innovation. Some of the same things with the states, by the way. Are you open to, frankly, a lot of great American companies like Google and Uber and Airbnb and others and Twitter? Are you open to them? Do you allow your citizens access? What kind of freedoms do you have? What's your broadband speed? You know, we're not the best on broadband speed or cost, frankly, as a country. Other countries are better. They're going to beat us on that. What kind of educational system do you have? What kind of...
Are you offering STEM degrees, science, technology, right, engineering, and math? You have to have that to drive innovation.
And we're looking at things, and we're still in the closing days of trying to figure out how to do it. For example, one of the things we're looking at are unicorns. A unicorn is a company with $1 billion in valuation. And the U.S. and China clearly have the most, but we also have a lot of population, too. So we're looking, maybe we should weight it by population, in which case you end up with a company like Bermuda, where if they have one, they win. Because it's a small population country with one. But we're working these things out, and we'll be announcing it at CES in January and having more to come as the year goes on.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Gary Shapiro. He's the longtime president and CEO of CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, which produces the annual CES show every January in Las Vegas. You know him from his 2013 book, Ninja Innovation. Well, let's talk about that CES show coming up. It's always bigger and better. It's always bigger. It's stunning. Tell people how big it is.
Well, we were in 2017, we were at 2.6 million square feet of exhibit space with over 4,000 exhibitors, and we attracted 186,000 people from around the world, including 60,000 from outside the United States, and we had about 7,000 media. The 2018 edition will be January 9th through 12th. We're not quite sure how big it will be. It will be at least comparable within a few thousand feet. I mean, we don't have much more room to expand in Las Vegas. And we're trying to restrict the number of attendees so that everyone has a great experience. And there's only so many hotel rooms and so many airplane seats coming in. And we don't want to put too much pricing pressure on it. We are away from the weekend this year, which is nice. So we're not competing with a normal Las Vegas crowd. But what's interesting about the CES is it attracts people from around the world who are focused on the future, on innovation, and it's the marketplace for innovation. We'll have 800 startups in Eureka Park. We'll have growing areas in sports technology. Not only the Internet of Things, which is huge there, but smart cities now is starting to see at CES. And we have so much growth in areas like robotics and drones. And that's where the future is going, because there's so many great things coming. And in the health tech area, that's off the charts, because smart people are coming up with ways to keep us healthier, all sorts of things, using these low-cost sensors that are now in every smartphone that are available for anyone to invent new things with. And so our philosophy of the show, anyone with any idea should be able to expose it to thousands of investors, media like yourself. We hope you'll be there, as well as partners. And the other phenomena we're seeing, frankly, is the biggest companies now are looking to the smallest entrepreneurs for investment partnership ideas, because it's tough to be a big company and to invent everything in your company the way it used to be. So all of a sudden now there's this big small thing going on, which is really healthy, I think, for the country.
Some people, some older engineers out there, remember CES from the early days. Describe when CES started and what it was like back then.
Well, I wasn't there, but it was 50 years ago in New York City, 1967. It was a breakout from the National Association of Music Merchants. And there was several thousand...
Music merchants?
Yes, because the guitars and the pianos, and they give a little space for these thing called electronics. And I guess then it was record players and not even color. I guess the black and white shifting to color, phonographs, and I'm trying to remember what other... radios. And that was it. But then things changed over time very quickly with color television. And in 1967, the guy who hired me, actually, he had this idea of getting everyone together, and it just grew very quickly. And it's not that we're brilliant in creating the right event at the time. The fact is innovators from the U.S. and around the world had these great ideas, and you know, the wireless and the DVD player and the CD player and high-definition television, the personal computer, and so many devices and things came across. So now at the show, we have a whole separate area just for self-driving cars and you know, robotics and things that we didn't even... I mean, it's not we didn't envision. There was definitely a lot of science fiction writers that got a lot of things right. We still haven't gotten the flying cars yet. I'm looking forward to that. but a lot of things, just measuring how we're doing and all these biomedical, biometric stuff is really good. And obviously, the internet was such a game changer, as was wireless in so many ways.
Well, I mean, some of these I want to talk to you about. First of all, the whole idea that we have, well, we don't have any flying cars this year. We know this. But the whole idea that there are all these drones, you know, and it's like, is that going to actually reduce this year? I mean, did that peak or is that expanding?
Well, the drone portion of the show is likely to expand. I try to avoid saying too much until we get there because sometimes companies join and they cancel right before the show or... God forbid there's a major weather event and they can't even get to the show, which occasionally happens, so you don't know. But generally, drones is a very, very hot and fast-growing category. We're projecting millions of units are going to be sold this year. It's a very large increase, and which means more and more companies come in. And the use case for them, the different things are being used for, people are coming up with more and more things. It's saving human safety from looking at bridges or things like that, or the fires that were in California in October. Drones help get the pictures. They help assess things, even like post-hurricane disasters, things like that. Public safety is really bigger and bigger and bigger on drones now because we need information. So it's not only the first responders, it's the emergency planning people could do their job, but it's also going to be delivery of life-saving things, of blood, of drug supplies. And in some countries around the world, they're way ahead of us, frankly, because they have a program to get drones anywhere in the country with medical supplies. But we're looking at, of course, as Amazon announced years ago, the just delivery of basic stuff. And if they're used right, even in cities, you could cut down on congestion. But there are issues to work out. There's privacy issues, safety issues, there's things like that.
We always see these successive waves. You know, the first one is, oh, we have the technology. Look at this, you know. And then we get the real apps. Where is it valuable? Where do people really want it? And frequently, you know, the original vision gets adjusted. You know, that's pretty typical. So it sounds like we're in that second wave with the drones. What exactly do we want to use them for and how? Now let's talk driverless cars, you know. The question is, who is ready for self-driving cars and who isn't?
Well, India says they're not because they will replace jobs in their view. I think history will prove them very wrong. So there's a job issue that some have raised, which we should talk about. But also, if you actually, we've done research and we've asked consumers what they think. And the readiness is clearly the younger you are, the more ready you are. But the other group that's ready, two groups, are people with disabilities. This is hugely empowering to them. And frankly, older people will find it empowering, and they're very supportive. Most car owners use a car on average 5% of the time. 95% of the time, that investment, which isn't very green in creating a car, is not being used. If you use it more, you should have fewer cars on the road. And park, if you don't have to look for parking with self-driving cars. There's so many advantages that come out of it, but there's a lot of issues to get through. They're not going to be perfect. But right now we have 35,000 people dying every year in the U.S. and hundreds of thousands hurt and injured. And this will save lives. And it's transformational. And it also empower people. It will change where they live. Like we've seen with Uber and Lyft, it's changing where people live. We're seeing younger people not buying cars now, living with their parents longer, moving to different places, to cities more. there's a generational shift going on that's absolutely huge, and it's much more dramatic than I think anything we've experienced in our lifetimes in terms of how they behave, how they get together with each other, what they do, how they even interact live versus socially on social media with each other. So this younger generation is ready for self-driving cars. They seem to be less desirous of owning things, like they're less likely to buy DVDs, for example. They're less likely to get a service to cable or satellite than just a few years ago. They're more getting things on broadband, and they're not constricted by when things are broadcast or satellite or cable shown. They're watching shorter media. There's so many things they're doing differently. So there are huge demographic differences. And self-driving cars, though, are inevitable to me because you can't say no to saving people's lives.
One of the things that I love about CES is that it's really the granddaddy. It's the big, big show for technology. And when you go there, you realize it's not just a U.S. show. It is a global show. How big is the international population that attend versus the U.S. population? Remembering that it's got to be heavily U.S. So much innovation happens here.
We have a lot of innovation here, and almost all the innovation used to happen here, but it's rapidly changing. For the first time, and I wouldn't have said this last year to you even, we are seeing tremendous innovation from China. They are focused on an innovation in every possible way from the very top down. Hundreds of thousands of startups, they are pushing it at every level. We have a show in Asia, and the show 2 years ago, I wouldn't have said there was a lot of innovation. The show this past June, tremendous amount, they're inventing things. Plus, France is focused on innovation laser. Like, that was Emmanuel Macron's thing. Emmanuel Macron has been to 4 CES events in the last 3 years. 2 of them in Las Vegas, and we have now almost 250 exhibitors coming from France, and they're playing off their strengths, their sensuality, the 5 senses. They even have products that smell things now, which is really interesting. The ramifications are huge for that in so many different ways. And we're seeing great interest from Britain and British prime ministers, and of course the Germans with their precision engineering. They're innovating. So every country I go to around the world wants to be like us. They see Silicon Valley. I say it's not just about Silicon Valley. We have pockets of innovation all around the country, which is what makes us so great. But it's a battle with the rest of the world, and we have to keep our edge.
Well, I got to say, I'm all over your flying car concept, and I'd like it to be at CES. I'd like there to be one of them because there's so many people there. Sometimes it's hard to get around, and I get it. So I want to go from point A to point B. I get in my flying car.
You'll get one, and then you'll see it at CES in the next few years.
Okay. I count on that. Gary, thank you so much. We hope to see you again anytime. This would be great.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you in Las Vegas next year.
My guest today is Consumer Technology Association President Gary Shapiro. Information on U.S. Tech Vets for military veterans and their spouses can be found at ustechvets.org. More information on CTA and the upcoming CES 2018 show in Las Vegas can be found on the web at cta.tech. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Podcasts of Tech Nation, Biotech Nation, and Tech Nation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, what is it that drives us humans to be creative and innovate? Anthony Brandt and David Eagleman join me to talk about the runaway species, how human creativity remakes the world. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. Anthony Brandt is a composer and professor of composition and theory at Rice University, the Shepherd School of Music. While Dr. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist, an inventor, an adjunct faculty in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine. In their book, The Runaway Species, they tell us to innovate is human.
We're born as human beings with software that is running in our brains all the time that create these dynamic remixes of our experience. And it is both ordinary and awesome at the same time.
And what the human brain is really special at, which differentiates us really from all our cousins in the animal kingdom, is that we take an input and we bend and break and blend it and constantly kick out new versions of the world. And we've got this enormous prefrontal cortex, which is the part right behind the forehead, which allows us to constantly generate possibilities, to generate what ifs.
Well, I had to chuckle when I read that. You start out very early in the book with that as a chapter. A basic Tech Nation rule is, if God didn't make it, it's technology. You know? So we were right there. So now beavers build dams, birds build nests. I mean, that's not technology. That's not innovation or creativity.
Oh, it is. It is. It's simply that what beavers and birds don't do is create the internet or get to the moon or create symphonies or theater plays. And the question is, what is it about the human brain that is, you know, very similar but algorithmically just a little bit different? What is it that allows us to have taken off on this exponential trajectory that we're on? Just, you know, if you fly over a forest, it looks the exact same as it did a million years ago. But when you fly over a city, like you're coming into London or New York, it's like a motherboard has risen out of the earth, and that's all due to one species.
Did that come on slowly, or was that right from the beginning?
It's picked up speed. So we had the agricultural revolution, the invention of writing and, you know, metalwork. This stuff was pretty slow. But what's happened just recently, really since the scientific revolution, is this unbelievable thing where everything is bootstrapping off everything else. And the situation we're in now is that kids come into a world where all of the discovery and technology and so on, that's just background for them. And they get to springboard from there. And we have almost 8 billion human brains running around the planet now, which means there's more interaction than ever before, and everyone gets to springboard off what everyone else is doing.
Now, David, you're the neuroscientist. Is that actually literally changing our brains?
Yes. Yeah, and it's because—
In a word, yes. I like that. No equivocation here. Yes.
Of course it is. It's because the world that we're in now, I mean, you've got the entirety of the knowledge that humankind has ever come up with in our pockets, and kids growing up can immediately get, okay, well, here's what it is to be inside an atom, and here's what the solar system looks like, and here's this new technology here and how it works and so on. You know, they can watch a TED talk and in 16 minutes get the best person in the world explaining exactly what they did. And so, yeah, it changes the brain in a very wonderful way.
Hmm. Now, David, of course, you are the neuroscientist, but Tony, you're a composer and a professor of music.
Yep.
How'd you two get together? How does that overlap?
Well, you know, we were working on a project together and we just started talking a lot about creativity in our own fields. David's designing a vest and now a wristband that can be worn by the deaf to enable them to hear through their skin. But what was really fascinating was he wasn't stopping with that, even as that is an amazing outcome, thinking of all sorts of other ways the very same principle could be applied in different ways. And it starts to sound like a theme in Variations to me. And we have a conversation, and the more we're talking about it, and we both have kids, send them to public schools, seen what happens to kids in a lot of our public school systems where the arts are taken out, where there's just this drive to get to the right answer at the back of the textbook. And, you know, 3 hours later, after talking and finding that we had so much overlap in the way we were thinking about creativity and how important we felt it was to cultivate it in our young, to cultivate it in our adult attitude towards life, we just said, well, let's write a book together.
What is a good definition of creativity?
Well, there's no question that creativity is a hard word to define. The standard scientific one revolves around the words novel and useful, and we have a problem with both of those. The problem with the word novel is it makes it seem like that's the only goal of creativity, but we argue all throughout the book that it's really this tension between the familiar and the novel and finding the sweet spot. And if you just say the word novel, you don't fully acknowledge how important it is that it just be some degree off of the familiar, but not so far that it becomes incomprehensible or confusing.
We hear that word novel a lot in like pharmaceutical, biotech. It's like it's a novel drug. It's like, and by that they mean it's something new, really
right,
new.
Right.
You know, but you can be too new.
Absolutely. And the history is filled with dustbins of ideas that were so far off the beaten track that nobody wanted to go there. Nobody was interested. And as much as it seems like we leap all the time, we actually move in gradual inches, step by step by step. And then the problem with the word useful is society changes its mind all the time about that. When Alfred Wegener was alive, the idea of continental drift was about as useless a scientific idea as you could possibly imagine. People thought he was just totally wasting his time, out of his mind. He died in the North Pole trying to find some evidence for this crazy idea that the plates moved and that Earth was not fixed. And of course, 20 years after his death, it became one of the most profoundly useful ideas ever. During his lifetime, Alfred Wegener was not a creative person by that definition. After his life, he became it. And that's a hard way to define something, and it's a hard way to study something. So I think we take a very material definition of creativity. It is a dynamic remix of the real world in which you produce something that hasn't existed before from your prior experience.
And the interesting thing is that creativity actually consists of two halves. One is the generation of new ideas. And the other bit is filtering those ideas. And as humans, we're quite good at this. In other words, our brains are constantly generating, what if this, what if that, what if that? Most of those ideas stink. Only a small fraction of those even percolate up to the conscious
brain.
Except
all of mine. Let's get straight who's the host here.
And of those that hit the conscious mind and you think, oh, what if, what if, what if? Most of those stink also. And it's just the occasional idea out of this proliferation of options that sticks, that actually makes sense. Oh, what if I did this with that and that and put those together? And so the filtering is a big part of it too. So people often ask us about things like psychedelic drugs, things like that. You know, that has the benefit of being able to generate new ideas, but you sort of lose the filtering part where you think everything is genius, and that's a problem. And it's the same thing with AI actually, which is to say, you know, AI can generate lots of interesting proliferations, tweaks on things, different options, but it's no good at the moment. It's saying, okay, well, this is what it's like to be a human, and here's what matters to humans, and here's what would actually stick.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Anthony Brandt and David Eagleman. Dr. Brandt is a composer and associate professor of composition and theory at Rice University, the Shepherd School of Music. And Dr. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist and adjunct faculty in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Together, they've written The Runaway Species, How Human Creativity Remakes the World. You start the book contrasting the experience of bringing back the crew from the ill-fated Apollo 13 and the experience of a young artist named Picasso. Can you quickly retell those stories, and how do they relate?
We decided we'd start the book with two legendary examples of creativity that at first glance seem to be polar opposites from each other. Apollo 13 had a disaster in mid-flight. They were going to land on the moon. And an oxygen tank blew, wrecking a huge part of the spacecraft. And the engineers at Mission Control were faced with a catastrophe beyond their imagining and a clock that was ticking down with an escalating series of problems that they had to solve as fast as possible, oxygen running out inside, having unusable parts of the craft. What are they going to do for reentry and such and so forth? And so they're working as a group. They're working on time. They're not trying to be original. They're just trying to solve problems. And then you have Picasso, who's working on his studio on a portrait of what he ends up deciding is going to be five prostitutes. And he's working on it over months, and he keeps drifting away from what he'd been doing before, further and further. And he shows his lover and his agent the painting, and they laugh at it. People start avoiding him in the hallways because they think he's out of his mind. He saw him embarrassed and uncertain about this painting, he actually rolls it up and sticks it in his closet for 9 years. So he's working all by himself. He's not trying to do something practical. He's not driving towards some solution where the clock is running out. And you take these two experiences, this majestic group experience of phenomenally creative to rescue those astronauts, and Picasso creating this epoch-breaking piece of art. And how could they be have anything in common? And then a large part of the book is showing how the same cognitive software is operating in all of their minds. And essentially, they are taking the raw materials that they're working with and thinking through them in the same way.
And of course, when you think of Picasso, you think of this cubist, you know, impression. He didn't start out painting that way.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, he's a great example of something that we keep talking about for ways of educating children. He mastered the past and then used it as a springboard. And the early periods of Picasso's life are among the most profoundly beautiful illustrations of that, where he is clearly ingesting the history of art that's around him and then remixing that and mashing it together in his mind, and also never considering that there's an end point and constantly reinventing himself.
One of the things that really matters to us is this issue about how we can educate the next generation better. But the important part is for children to learn what has come before them and then springboard off of that to make mixes and mashups of what they've just learned. And this is what is illustrated in Picasso's life, is this, you know, this mastery of what came before and then the springboarding. And that is exactly the theme about education.
I think also a good point is with the Apollo 13, this is a spacecraft. There is whatever's on it is on it.
Right. That's right.
Nothing new. It's even pointed in the wrong direction. It's traveling away from Earth.
Right.
So their creativity isn't like, well, it's limited to what's there. No, you have to get creative with what is there. And they got amazingly creative.
Well, then our argument is that that's a great case study of what's always true in all creativity. There's no component of what Picasso made that actually didn't come from ingredients that he drew on in his life. There was no magic thing. There was no extra flash of lightning. It was going to a museum and seeing African masks in one place, being inspired by a painting of El Greco where he imitated the proportions of the canvas, a way of imagining more geometric forms in the painting of Cézanne. I mean, you begin to see the lineage and the roots and the family tree of everything that Picasso is doing. It doesn't diminish his originality one iota because a whole mess of other people around him had access to exactly those same ingredients. Only Picasso painted Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, but he had his own version of the spacecraft. It was the culture of his time.
And that's exactly what we see with all technological innovation. So in 2006, when Steve Jobs announced the iPhone, it was seen as completely revolutionary, and this is how the media covered it. But in fact, the genealogy is quite obvious when you look back at that. And in fact, IBM had released a touchscreen cell phone in 1993 called the Simon. And it was big and clunky. It was sort of as big as a brick, and it had a lousy little touchscreen thing. But all the roots had been there for over two decades. Mm. And this is the type of thing we see everywhere. Again, as Tony said, this doesn't diminish the wonderfulness of remixing things in a different way, but it is not the case that any idea comes from nowhere.
One of the arcs of the book are the three Bs, bending, breaking, and blending. What's the difference between those?
So our argument is that there is a framework we present that basically the landscape of cognitive operations that brains do when they're being creative can be divided into three categories. Blending is like a theme in variations. It's taking some archetype and just constantly generating new versions of it, which are rooted in the source but are not exact reproductions of it. Changing its size, changing its texture, changing the color. I mean, it's infinite what you can do. Every time a jazz performer performs the same standard night after night in a nightclub, never duplicating themselves, that's the bending concept. Breaking is just like it sounds. You take something whole, you shatter it into pieces, take it apart, and now you've got fragments which you can use as raw materials in a more flexible way. And blending is marrying two or more concepts together. So in ancient Greece, you take a man, you blend it with a bull, and you get a minotaur. And what we argue in the book is that those three operations, bending, breaking, and blending are intertwined in the way that we approach reality, mash it up, digest it, and turn it into something else.
Now, David, let me ask you, you talk about the difference between overt and covert creativity. What is that, and is that different in the brain?
No, the key is that it's exactly the same in the brain. It's the same operations running. What happens in the arts is that the bending, breaking, and blending is overt. You can see, oh, wow, this artist has mashed these things. You know, I.M. Pei put a glass pyramid in the courtyard of the Louvre. And so we say, oh, look at this, how he's blended these two cultures. And people will break things in arts all the time, or they'll bend them like a Frank Gehry piece of architecture where you take a flat facade of a building and you make it wobbly. And so you can see these overtly in the arts. What's interesting is that exactly the same cognitive operations are happening in the brain when people are doing science and tech. But, you know, when you pick up your cell phone, it's all hidden away. All of the creativity that built that device, you can't see it. It's simply that that's covert in the sciences, it's overt in the arts. This is one of the reasons why arts education is so important in schools. Unfortunately, it's one of the first things to get dropped when the school is running out of budget. But the reason it's important is because this is where the kids get lots of practice at bending, breaking, and blending. Whereas in science classes, unfortunately, it's usually taught where you're just trying to get to the answer in the back of the book, and that's the end of it.
It's really very interesting because I teach a number of different kinds of students, and including science students, and the sort of the bomb in the middle of any syllabus that I write that makes a lot of people crazy is I require them to do in their final project something that's new. It's never been done before. A new insight. It's like you're supposed to go out and get all this stuff and not just report on it, which they're absolutely aces at, but you got to come up with something new. It's an interesting thing how we've come to this point and we're not – that the innovation is not a routine part of education.
Yes. So, of course, there are some good reasons for that in terms of – making sure kids are getting a standardized sense of what they're accomplishing in school, and it feels like it's more measurable when you can test them. And we feel very strongly that cognitive flexibility is going to be even more at a premium in the future, and our world is reshaping itself so fast that setting kids on tracks that are going to not even lead to a path in the future is a very short-sighted way of educating them, and that their creativity, which is innate part of the glory of being a human being, is going to be called upon even more powerfully in the future. It's very, very important that they have these open-ended kind of questions like you're describing, where and they learn to embrace and enjoy that. You know, the NASA has this wonderful Imagine Mars project where the kids, you know, they're real scientists right now figuring out how to have a Mars colony, and they're giving the kids the same task. And there's no right answer. Nobody's written that textbook yet. And the kids have to deal with all sorts of things like oxygen and waste management and how you're going to grow food and so on. And just getting the kids comfortable with envisioning a world that's still far off in the future that, in fact, they will be the makers of, and living with the not knowing the outcome.
In fact, when you look at the jobs that exist now that didn't even exist 30 years ago, you know, you can make a living as a blogger or a multimedia designer or so on. When we think about where the world's going to be 30 years from now, when our children are adults and out in the world, we can't even imagine the jobs that are going to exist. Therefore, teaching them sort of the standard stuff with the hopes that the world will continue as is the wrong idea. And instead, it's teaching our children to be cognitively flexible and be able to leverage the next opportunity and the next. That's what we want to be teaching.
Well, what about adults? You know, we're not chopped liver. Come on. can we all get more creative?
Absolutely. I think one of the most profound discoveries of neuroscience in the last decade is that brain plasticity is throughout life. And our ability to be cognitive flexible, again, the arts tell wonderful stories about the greatest creators reaching their highest achievements when they're older. It's just a matter of making it a habit and a practice. And, you know, it can be from the very, very small, like making holiday and greeting cards for your family, and they're more personalized and they have more of the flair of who you are and who they are, new recipes, to things that are really connected with anything that we're passionate and care about, where the world would benefit from our contribution creatively.
And one of the ways to achieve that as an adult is to figure out how to get ourselves off the path of least resistance, because we get so automatized as adults. But it's actually quite important to knock yourself off of that, to say, I'm not going to take the most obvious route or the fastest answer that I know is the right answer, but instead I'm going to try something new. I'm going to drive a different route home from work. I'm going to change the way my office is arranged. I'm going to switch which hand I'm wearing my Fitbit on, and so on. These are all very simple things, but the point is to get off of the path of automation, because most of our lives become totally automatized. And the important part for creativity is figuring out how to dig deeper and get new answers from your brain, because your brain has a very rich harvest in there. It's just that we tend to take the shortest path. So proliferating options, trying things at different distances from what you're used to, embracing risk, and so on.
Well, I think what's interesting as well is this isn't just, you know, developing a new habit. Like when you get out of the shower and you dry off, fold the towel this way and put it on the rack. And after about, you know, 30 times of doing that, if you've ever raised teenage boys, you have to have a couple of tricks to get them to get there. Otherwise, they're on the ground in, you know, a wet lump. This is interesting in that when there is something new, you know, like the endorphins kick in, you get excited, you know, that you've created that. What's going on in the brain there?
So it turns out that what the brain really gets reward from is this interesting middle ground between familiarity and novelty. So things that are familiar, the brain really likes that. That's how it gets its grounding. But also, we're always leaning into the future. We like things that are a little bit new. So what our brains have is this trade-off between exploitation of what we already know and exploration of the unknown. And the interesting part is that creativity exists right in the middle of that, where things are familiar and yet new in some way. And this is the interesting part, is that when you're creating something new, you never know exactly what's going to stick in society. So what great creatives all do is they cover the spectrum. They do some things that are sort of standard and so on, and they do some things that are really way out and wacky and everything in between. And then, you know, and you find out where the border of the possible is that way.
And of course, you've dropped in some neuroscience things that, you know, are kind of interesting in the middle, such as repetition suppression. Let's talk about that.
With repetition suppression, if you show something to the brain, something new, your brain has a big response to that. And then you show it the exact same thing, it has a little bit less of a response. You show it the same thing again, it has less of a response, and so on. And what happens is, if you repeat the same thing to the brain, it has less and less of a response, to the point where it doesn't respond at all. And this is actually very quickly that it does this. Why? It's because the brain is building an internal model of the outside world. And as soon as it gets something, it says, oh, okay, now I get it. That thing that was so new a minute ago, like Wi-Fi and airplanes, now that's just part of the background. I got it. And you have less of a brain response to it. This is the thing that causes us to always be seeking the novel. We're always, you know, incorporating things into our model of the world and then seeking new bits.
And, you know, if you've been in a long-term relationship, you're familiar with repetition suppression because you're
if you're so fortunate to have gotten that far.
Your mate figures they know everything you're going to say before you say it, and they tune you out. And it's a reminder of how important novelty is for engaging each other. We're one of less than two dozen social species on the planet. And this inner capacity we have to generate what-ifs and imagine alternative futures, matched with our need to surprise and engage each other in order to remain alert and connected and bonded, that virtuous loop is what has driven creativity throughout human history.
So not only should you make an effort to listen to your spouse or your other, you should make an effort to introduce new little things, so they might
absolutely
miss,
yes.
No, they if they don't listen, they might miss something.
It's why humor is so important to us. I mean,
but only tell the joke once.
That's right. Exactly.
Did I just listen? Did I get that? Okay, twice you might get away with, but forget it after that. Forget it after that. Another aspect that I completely understood from an engineering standpoint, but I didn't get from a general creativity standpoint, was the fact that to be creative, you're not really – it's a human activity. It's a social activity. But that's a different idea than, for instance, an artist or a composer, something like that.
Well, one would think it's a different idea, but in fact, when an artist or a composer comes up with something, what matters is the reception in the world. Does the rest of the community care about it? One of the interesting things that Tony and I looked at when we were writing our book was this issue of, okay, let's look at, for example, 19th century Japanese theater versus 19th century French theater versus 19th century Cambodian theater and so on. And what you find is that these are all really different. Now, the interesting part is that it's not that somebody couldn't have done something just like a French person or Cambodian, but they don't, because what matters is your culture. What matters is what is going to be received well in your context, in your moment in space and time, how you can do something that takes the familiar and tweaks it just a little bit to make something new out of that. And so the really important part when thinking about creativity is the rest of the social world around you. And what humans spend essentially most of their time doing is trying to surprise and impress one another. And I don't mean this in a negative way. This is actually a really wonderful thing that humans do. And this is why you don't tell the same joke twice, because it wouldn't surprise you the second time I tell it. And so one of the suggestions we make in the book is that if you really want to up the progress of artificial intelligence, what you should do is make a community of artificial intelligent agents who are all trying to surprise and impress one another. And by doing that, you would really bootstrap the process.
There's a beautiful quote from the avant-garde artist Philip Guston, who says, "You make a big leap and then you walk it back just so you can move one inch." And that's really a wonderful way of summarizing the whole way creativity is working. A personal impulse, the community that receives it, and a negotiation that is constantly going on.
Now, you contend that the sciences need the arts. Why?
I think one of the blind sides in this argument is that the arts are over here and the sciences are over here, and only if the arts are kind of illustrating the sciences are they actually serving a child's education. And we really want to argue very strongly, you know, sure, they can help illustrate the sciences, but their great power is in training that cognitive software and allowing you to practice it when you're 5 years old onwards, before you can deal with dangerous chemicals or fancy machinery. Thinking about taking the raw materials around you, and whether it's a collage or a play or a piece of music, going through exactly the same mental operations that later on may lead to fantastic patents and great discoveries.
Well, Tony and David, thank you so much for joining me. Please come back. See me again.
We would love to. Thank
great.
You so
Thanks
much.
Thanks very much.
My guests today are Anthony Brandt and David Eagleman. The book is The Runaway Species, How Human Creativity Remakes the World. It's published by Catapult. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.